This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women. We feature thought leaders at all career levels, where we explore, among other things, the many contributions that women make to the fields of international business, national security, foreign policy, and international development. Does having women in positions of power influence the outcomes of decisions in these fields? Why or why not? Join me, Dr. Kathleen McInnes, Director of the Smart Women, Smart Power Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, for these incredible conversations. For decades, the U.S. Treasury Department has used the American dollar as a key instrument for shaping and executing American foreign policy. However, in an era of rising authoritarian actors set out to undermine democracies, can the United States and its currency survive the latest threats? With over a decade of firsthand reporting, senior Washington correspondent for Bloomberg News, Saleha Mohsen, joins us today to talk about her new book, Paper Soldiers: How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. I'm your host, Kathleen McInnes, and this is Smart Women, Smart Power. This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women. Well, welcome, Saleha. I'm so thrilled to have you here at CSIS, and congratulations. Like, first of all, congratulations on the book. Holy crap, just putting a book out there is such an enormous process. So first things first, I want to congratulate you on that.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. I'm so excited to be here, so excited to talk about my book and to talk about women.
Well, so to start off our conversation, we Smart Women, Smart Power listeners know we love to get into people's origin stories. Like, so what brought you into the world of journalism and what drove you to the economy beat?
I think my journey started in fifth grade.
Wow. Okay.
When I won an essay writing contest. If you remember DARE.
Yeah, like the anti-drug thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
So for that, there was a contest. I think everyone had to submit an essay, and I won. So I read my essay in front of the school. They had to put a little booster thing for me to reach the mic at the podium. And that's kind of when I realized maybe there's a writing talent here. I can't do math. Science is hard. Writing might be my thing. So I kind of stuck to it.
Sure.
Journalism, you know, my mom, when I was 15, said, you could consider being a journalist. And I was like, oh, you don't even know who I am. And then I was, I was 18. Yeah. I walked onto the campus at the University of Cincinnati, my alma mater. And the first thing I did was went to the student newspaper and said, I want to start writing for you guys. I got paid $10 per article, but I had a blast. The best way to learn the trade is to just do it rather than sitting in a classroom.
Right.
When I think about my journey to business and finance and economic reporting, it was kind of by accident.
Sure. Okay.
I fell into it. It was the first job out of college that I could find. And I, you know, I only applied. I applied to a lot of things sort of randomly. This one, I had someone making an introduction for me, a professor. And I got the job. I was the cub reporter who was writing the web stories in 2005 when for this local regional business paper that was weekly in Ohio, out of Columbus, Ohio, called Columbus Business First, had mostly the weekly like newspaper version between a magazine and a newspaper. And then they had some online stuff. Now everyone's a web reporter over there, but I was the first one to sort of start working on that stuff. And I started working there and it was hard. I struggled to get my head around financial statements and stuff. But then I very quickly realized that with economic coverage and business reporting, you always know what the story is. It's money. It's what the money and the economy means.
Sure.
And that gets to big businesses, it gets to government, and it gets to the heart of our day-to-day lives and problems.
So you're going from the local to your, you know, Bloomberg News. I'd be curious about your perspectives on the interaction between local business and economic news and national. And I don't know, I was literally having a conversation earlier today about economic impacts of big strategic decisions and how to communicate the economic shocks to, you know, Americans sitting in like Ohio or, you know, who aren't necessarily thinking about big strategic stuff. So just curious for your reflections on that.
Yeah, this is something that I was able to weave into the book.
Yeah.
Paper Soldiers. I take readers through what aspects of government policy affect their lives. But sure. Then I take readers to Weirton, West Virginia, and Moraine, Ohio, to talk about locally, how did some of these government policies that promoted, in the case of my book, globalization, affect the Rust Belt states? I went to a specific community to talk about that. So I think that local journalism picks up on things maybe a little bit before the national media does. And it's just a little bit of a shame that a lot of local outlets have folded and become much thinner than they used to be.
Right. I mean, it's almost like a crisis in journalism that we're losing so many of these local outlets, especially if they're bellwethers for these bigger issues. So to turn to the decision, or maybe amplifying on what you just spoke about, you know, the decision you brought with us today, your new book, Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed World Order. How did you know that the story needed to be written?
That's interesting. One, there are a lot of books on the Fed. There are a lot of terrific books on the Fed, but there's a lot. There's a great musical on the Treasury Department, Hamilton, and there are a lot of autobiographies by Treasury secretaries, but there's no book about the Treasury Department. So I saw a bit of a white space.
Sure.
Yeah. Huh. The other
that's a gap in the literature for sure.
Absolutely. It was my big selling point. The other way that I got to it is, so I covered the Treasury Department, the tail end of the Jack Lew Treasury under Obama, all of Steven Mnuchin under Trump, and the first half of Janet Yellen under Biden. Directly on the Treasury beat. And I saw how much changed in terms of economic policies that touched Treasury and our lives. You know, we spun on a dime on a lot of things. We went from globalization to looking inward, more protectionist policies to address some of the populism that we were seeing across the country. But one interesting thing that I saw was, you know, I'm not a dilettante. I covered Treasury for, like, you know, from a wire reporter view, like the day-to-day shuffling of paper. I traveled around the world with secretaries, hitting more than a dozen countries, interviewing Treasury secretaries on planes, on a train, and a car. And I saw how giant the job had become. So January 6th, setting aside some of the other emotions of that day, around that time or just after that, there was news that maybe Steven Mnuchin was involved in an effort to trigger the 25th Amendment for President Trump. And something hit me. I just thought, in the last 3 weeks, the principle that I cover so closely, for the agency that I cover so closely, Mnuchin was involved in congressional talks about spending to deal with COVID. He traveled to the Middle East to forward our sort of foreign policy agenda as it touches international economic policy. He had announced sanctions, economic sanctions. That's part of our geopolitical strategy. And then he was also possibly, maybe, who knows if he really was or wasn't. You can dig into the book and find out what I reported on that. But, and he was also possibly talking about the 25th Amendment. I just thought, how can one person, one agency be in charge of so much? I want to write about it.
Well, and, you know, I would say it's becoming less the case, but traditionally, you know, the economic instruments of national power have been sort of siloed off from this broader national security discussion, but it's so deeply interrelated, right?
Absolutely. And it's gotten more and more interrelated. And that's one of the key themes in the book about how the U.S. Treasury Department went from being more about economic policy and international economics and the domestic side of that, you know, debt financing, tax policy, financial regulation, to being a part of the national security and foreign policy apparatus. And that's through economic sanctions. And that started with 9/11. If you think back to September of 2001, September 24th, and I lay this out in a chapter called A War Office for Treasury in the book. And on September 24th, about 2 weeks after the terrorist attacks, George W. Bush launched the Global War on Terror.
Yep.
It wasn't – the first move wasn't the ruling of military tanks or boots on the ground or a machine gun. Mm-hmm. It was the Treasury Department using right. its economic prowess through the U.S. dollar mm-hmm. to track the financial footprints of terrorist organizations and how they financed this terrorist plot and how they may be financing future ones.
As memory serves, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was also a key part of the playbook for countering the Islamic State.
Yeah, that's yeah. correct. Yeah, yeah absolutely. Okay. If you can find the money flow and mm-hmm. cut it off, then how are they going to pay for a terrorist attack?
Right. So this gets into the question of overuse, right? And you, because when American policymakers, or at least in my perception, is when they see a problem, they don't want to exercise military force, so and they want to make a point. You use these economic tools, but sanctions, for example, are a very blunt instrument and very difficult to walk back. It's just it's a sledgehammer when sometimes you need a scalpel, and also the more and more you use them, the more incentive you have to, or more incentive our adversaries have to find other networks of finance. So I'm just wondering if you your views on that and how does this impact the ability of the American statecraft using the Treasury?
This is the debate that's raging in Washington right now.
Yeah.
In a lot of economic and foreign policy circles is like, are sanctions effective? Have we overused this weapon? And that's the thrust of the book. Have we weaponized the dollar? So just to take a couple of ticks back, the U.S. is able to have very impactful economic sanctions because we are the owner of the world's reserve asset.
Yeah.
That means we are the lifeblood of the global economy. Pretty much no one can transact in any country without touching the dollar. And right. that means when the U.S. thinks that, well, your foreign policy or what you just did, that's bad behavior, how can we punish you? We'll cut you off from the dollar. And that's a very simplistic definition.
Sure,
there's
sure.
a lot of degrees of it. Economic sanctions have actually become more sophisticated.
Okay.
There's a lot of nuance to what they can do. And it's kind of seen as a vice that you slowly tighten.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Where,
so not a sledgehammer, a vice.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Cool. They used to be, I think, economic embargoes were more right. of a sledgehammer. But now it's, you know, you could see the president or the treasury secretary, even the mere threat of sanctions causes a reaction.
Right.
From the bad actors, so-called bad actors, to pull back, or it causes people who are transacting with bad actors to pull back a little bit. Mm-hmm. So the government uses that to kind of start moving down the spectrum and tightening slowly of threatening or actually doing it, but finding a few carve outs and then slowly tightening a bad actor's reach and ability to access the U.S. dollar. Mm-hmm. But the debate these days, you're right, Kathleen, that there is a lot of talk about, have we overused this weapon?
Yeah.
Some of that is coming out of what's going on in Russia. You know, 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, the U.S. led more than half the world to levy the biggest sanctions package we've ever seen.
Yeah.
You know, Russia is a G20 country, at the time was the 11th largest economy, and we cut the central bank off of the dollar.
Wow.
But the war is still going.
Right. Right. Well, and your use of the word weaponized is so interesting because, you know, one of the, when we think about this world order that we created post World War II, right? And part of the reason that the U.S. was accepted as the reserve currency, or that the dollar was accepted as reserve currency, is because we had the global buy-in, or the West's buy-in, and support for U.S. leadership. How does that change if allies and adversaries are beginning to see a weaponization of this currency, a weaponization of the dollar.
Yeah, you're right. It started after World War II, just before World War II ended, when the global community came together and thought, well, how can we make sure another world war doesn't happen? If right. we are economically integrated, then if I hurt you, it's a self-inflicted wound, right? And so everyone kind of very intentionally, by design, crowned the dollar king dollar in that mm-hmm. moment. Now we're seeing, okay, reach this peak power. We're seeing, is it plateauing? What's going to happen next? Are people finding ways around the dollar? If they are, what does that mean for the dollar's reach, for its power, for the strength of economic sanctions? What I'll tell you, Kathleen, is that there's more talk than action. A lot of people are talking a big game about, BRICS Plus getting together saying, sure. why are we so reliant on the dollar? Russia and India, or Russia and China, finding ways to transact outside of the dollar, including parts of the Gulf state, also saying we can trade oil using different currencies than the dollar. There's something wrong with that, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
It's not great that this conversation is going on, and the U.S. Treasury Department officials who talk about the dollar are a little bit on the defensive footing.
Interesting.
Defending okay. yeah. that the U.S. dollar is fine, guys.
Yeah.
But also, there's nothing wrong with people trading in other currencies. It doesn't have to be just the dollar all the time. But what I'll tell you is that when there is a crisis, a global mm-hmm. pandemic,
yep.
Any kind of financial crisis, or a mini crisis in a specific region of the world,
mm-hmm.
countries, investors, businesses flock to the dollar. It is still seen as the safest place to store wealth. The U.S. is still seen as the best place to invest because mm-hmm. you'll get a return on your money. The U.S. still has rule of law, free and fair elections, an open democracy, independent agencies.
Mm-hmm. Can you see scenarios or future scenarios in which that would not be the case?
I think as long as the U.S., right now we are at a self-critical moment.
Yeah.
It's the yeah. nature of a democracy.
Yeah.
We will be loud about our problems.
Yeah.
Because we are trying to solve them.
Yep.
And there's a willingness to let it get messy. Mm-hmm. And we're in the messy phase, I think, right now.
Yeah.
With a bit of
personal. Something that's very hard for, I think, allies and partners, as well as adversaries, to understand. The chaos is part of the process.
It right? is part of the process.
It's the design.
And right? it's part of the fabric of our nation. We've had yeah. tough times. We had a civil war. Even the Reconstruction era after the Civil War was disruptive. We had the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. We had, Nixon, Watergate. Everyone thought, what's going to happen to this country and its credibility and integrity now?
Right.
We're having this again. It feels a lot worse than it's ever been. Who knows whether that's true or not? That feeling is real. I think that as long as the U.S. can get itself on track and manage public financing in mm-hmm. a responsible mm-hmm. manner,
right?
No playing chicken with the debt ceiling,
right?
Don't bring it to the deadline to 11:59 and then say pat yourself on the back and say, "But we didn't default,"
yeah.
right? Because yeah. the fight is bad enough,
right?
Right. If your parents fight all the time, but they never get a divorce, it's great they're not getting a divorce, but the fighting is affecting you, right? So this fight right. is affecting the country and its credibility and its integrity, especially when it comes to the dollar and U.S. treasuries.
So do you think your gender as a woman had an impact on your decision to take on this topic, to do this work? And if so, why? But if not, why not?
Yeah, I thought long and hard about this after I listened to a couple of your episodes, knowing that this question could come up. Writing a book is a natural path for a journalist, mm-hmm. I'll say. I think in a way it did affect the decision because I remember when I told a few professional confidants that I was, I'd found an agent or mm-hmm. and there was some interest and I'm redoing my proposal before we send it to publishers. A couple of people said to me, "Oh, well, it's really hard to write a book and work full time." And they said, "Well, so-and-so that I used to know at some big newspaper outlet did that, but he's a genius." And I just thought, well, do you think he's a genius because he's already done it?
That's interesting.
You know, and so I think I kind of dug in.
Yeah.
Thinking, would you have said that if I was a man?
Right, yeah.
I just kind of dug in thinking, yeah. I have an agent interested. He's seen the written proposal. These people right. who are saying, maybe you shouldn't do this, maybe it's too soon, have not seen the written proposal, and they're not in the book industry.
Right.
So also, I think in this backhanded way, it did actually affect my decision.
That's interesting. And also, we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Absolutely.
So to conclude our conversation, I'd be curious, especially given everything you've learned about the dollar as an instrument of statecraft, but as a weaponization of the American dollar. I'm curious as to your views on what power means to you.
To me, power means knowing and accepting that you can only control the controllable.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's what I learned in that moment I just shared. Mm-hmm. That I can't control whether they're going to wholeheart, this professional confidant or two of mine are going to fully support me in this moment.
Right.
To take this big step to writing a book. But I can control my reaction to it. Mm-hmm. I could wither away from it and think, oh, they might be right. Or I could say, I know myself better. I know the situation better. I'm going to keep marching forward. Yeah. It's the same with writing a book, you know? Mm-hmm. It's hard to put yourself out there and promote. I mm-hmm. think like when I promote stories for Bloomberg News, I always get to say we yeah. at Bloomberg, me and my colleagues, even if it happens to be just my name on the byline, I can always say we because there's editors and other colleagues who are involved.
Yeah.
With the book, there's a lot of I, and as a woman, that's difficult, but I have sort of steps outside of that comfort zone a little bit to say, hey, like I have a unique view. The best way to support a first-time author is to click that button and buy the book. And it's so hard to say that. It yeah. is so hard for me to say, look at me right now. I'm couching it in all this, like, all these excuses.
Sing it. Like, I, you know, I've experienced the same thing myself. It's like, it's so profoundly uncomfortable to just sort of be the, like, that self-promotion, the shameless self-promotion yeah. and just putting yourself out there like that. But you have to sell books because you need the story to get out there. You need the readership to understand these different perspectives. So it's a lot of, you just feel, I felt like a cheese ball
oh, the entire time. Absolutely. Like, yeah, when I hear it, when someone else, another author comes to me mm-hmm. or I see a social media promotion, I think, oh yeah, okay, I'll click. Mm-hmm. And I don't yeah. even think twice about it.
Right. And then, but behind the scenes, like, yeah. Well, congratulations, Alea. Again, putting out a book is such an incredible accomplishment. So congratulations, and thank you so much for joining us in Smart Women, Smart Power.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here.
Subscribe to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to great content. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Smart Women, or you can follow me on Twitter at KJ McInnes1. Thanks for listening, and join us next time.